Welcome to Onc Live at ASCO 2026. We're going to be talking about treatment intensification in metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer in vulnerable populations with a focus on androgen receptor pathway inhibitors in patients who are frail, elderly, or have comorbid disease. I'm Dr. Martin Schoen, an associate professor at St. Louis University and at the VA in St. Louis. And I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Andrew Hahn.
My name is Andy Hahn. I'm an assistant professor of GU Medical Oncology at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas.
So to begin, I want to set the stage and ask Dr. Hahn about what do you think about treatment of metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer, also now known as metastatic androgen pathway modulation-sensitive prostate cancer?
Yeah, no, and like the language has changed recently, but big picture, we have a backbone of ADT that we've had for a really long time to treat metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer. And over the last 8-9 years now, we've added in 4 different AR pathway inhibitors that further inhibit the action of testosterone. So now the standard of care is ADT plus one of either abiraterone, enzalutamide, apalutamide, or darolutamide. And so this is our standard of care at this point. This is all driven by registrational phase 3 clinical trials. And very consistently across all 4 of those studies, the use of any one of these ARPIs was associated with about a 50% reduction in the hazard for radiographic disease progression. And for 3 out of the 4 studies, with the exception of darolutamide, they was associated with a 35% reduction in the hazard for death. And this result was statistically significant. So now the standard of care is at least ADT plus an AR pathway inhibitor. And then in certain patients and in select scenarios, we can also think about adding in docetaxel chemotherapy. But I know we're not going to even enter that conversation today. We're going to keep this as ADT and AR pathway inhibitors.
Yeah, so thank you for that great summary. So you'd really say that combination therapy is the way to go. It's the standard. It's no longer actually considered to be intense. It's really what should be the baseline for almost every patient.
Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt about it. Clinical trials have established that. I think that the only questions, and we're going to go into this in a lot of detail as we start walking through all the data, the only questions that have evolved over time are kind of as patients get older in age,
right.
And we're going to talk a lot about clinical trial representation and real-world data, but as they get older in age, we had that stopgap meta-analysis that was presented at GU ASCO, not this year, but the year prior. I still don't think it's been published. But in that study, we saw that there was some impact on age on the efficacy of abiraterone, but we did not see that same impact on the other AR antagonists, that being enzalutamide, apalutamide, or darolutamide. And we can dig into that data more or kind of what other data there is to complement that.
Well, I did want to ask specifically about enzalutamide. You know, I work mainly in the Veterans Affairs population, and so the 2 most common drugs that we use are abiraterone or enzalutamide. And so if you had to make comments on enzalutamide and its role across the prostate cancer spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, I think enzalutamide's somewhat unique in that, or relatively unique in that we have it across the whole spectrum. And it's probably why at the VA you guys have both abiraterone and enzalutamide, is they cover the whole spectrum. Enzalutamide and abiraterone were initially approved early 2010s. In the metastatic castration-resistant or APMR prostate cancer setting was when they were initially approved, and then have slowly moved their way forward into these studies that I just mentioned with in the hormone-sensitive space. And then Enza is relatively unique as well in that it's approved for biochemical recurrence of prostate cancer, so even prior to metastases, when patients are considered high risk, which is a PSA doubling time of less than 9 months. And then even more unique for it, and we'll probably talk about this as we dig into some of age and frailty, is the opportunity to use enzalutamide as monotherapy, specifically in that high-risk BCR setting, although I'll admit that sometimes I stretch that. And the definition of BCR has definitely evolved and changed from the EMBARK trial, which was done in the 2010s, into the post-PSMA PET era, where now we're oftentimes finding metastases for these patients. But just to say, we now have it kind of all the way from BCR up to metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer.
What you've been talking about is several, you know, pivotal clinical trials. You know, EMBARK is in that biochemically recurrent space. We know that we have ARCHES that is in the metastatic castration-sensitive space. But I wanted to sort of get your thoughts about the populations that are represented in these trials. And, you know, what are the types of patients that are typically in the registrational phase 3 trials? And are there some patients that may not always be included and we're not always sure exactly how to treat them?
Yeah, absolutely, Marty. I think it's really a good point. Clinical trials are not ultimately designed, nor are they representative of the general population. You know this as well as anybody practicing at a VA. But patients in registrational clinical trials are typically younger than the patients that we see in the real world. You look at real world data, you're going to see a median age at diagnosis of somewhere around 73 or 74 for patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. If you go look at any of those registrational trials, we're looking at 67 to 69 as our median ages. So much younger, generally a lot less comorbidities, a lot less drug-drug interactions. Depending upon the study, you can have different geographic sites represented. Actually, if you look at the darolutamide study, the ARANOTE study that got it approved, it wasn't even conducted in the United States, so not applicable to our patients always. And then the other one is that ultimately we don't, as a community, do a great job of enrolling minorities to these trials either. If we look at the general U.S. population, Black or African-American patients make up about 12% of the general U.S. population. If we go look at registrational clinical trials, unfortunately, they're representing 2 to 4% typically. So we don't know the patient who oftentimes lives down the street from us or walks into clinic. Our data doesn't perfectly apply to them. And it creates, I think, a window or a gap in data that can be filled by a number of different places. And I want to turn now over to kind of asking you some questions here on this front as well as we do that. But before I get there, I guess, Marty, for you, what proportion of patients that you're seeing in the VA, and I can add in here too, with metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer, would you characterize as elderly, frail, or medically complex who would not have been represented in a registrational clinical trial?
I think that that's an appropriate thing to consider because you're completely right. Over half of my patients are 74 or older, which is not what's in some of the pivotal clinical trials. And many of them have also multiple comorbid diseases, you know, things that really affect the cardiovascular system, such as diabetes or hypertension, are incredibly common. Over 80% of veterans have hypertension and, you know, at least approximately 30% have diabetes. And when you combine those things, it does really make a population that can sometimes be, you know, more difficult to treat. And so I would say that, you know, more than half of my patients would fit into that sort of category of, you know, maybe they're elderly, but also have one or two more, you know, other diseases that are really important and affect their life, and then also have frailty. A lot of times frailty is just, you know, difficulty in doing some of the functions of daily life, such as, you know, cooking or bathing or taking care of yourself or just, you know, walking with a walker, and having that sort of complex care needs that, you know, do sometimes make it difficult to, you know, either adhere to therapy, but also, you know, benefit from the more complex treatments that we do.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. At MD Anderson, I'm fortunate to get to enroll a lot of patients on clinical trials. Sometimes clinical trial patients are representative of the patients I see, but I also have a lot of patients that come to us from the community and do not look like the patients enrolling on clinical trials. And it's a lot of the same things you just described. And I'll even add in that you brought this up, but like polypharmacy is a huge issue for when you get into metastatic prostate cancer. I mean, you have a patient who's 75 with multiple other comorbidities, and then patients are juggling, hey, I'm going to add 4 or 5 more pills into this group of 20 or 30 pills that I'm already taking. It really can be a significant barrier for some patients. And that leads us into the next question for you, which is, what challenges does that mismatch between trial populations that we see and represented here at ASCO and other places and real-world patients make for you when you're trying to make treatment decisions in clinic?
Well, definitely. I think it does sort of limit my knowledge of some of the adverse events that can possibly occur. I like to always talk to my patients about what do you expect and what are the types of things that could happen and what is normal or what is actually something that's, you know, more serious that we really need to make a treatment change or possibly hold treatment. And so when a patient that has higher levels of frailty and multiple comorbid illnesses, we are frequently having to make modifications. And I typically look to clinical trials and package inserts, but unfortunately that's not very, not there because the populations that were represented in that data are not like the patients that I see. And so I do commonly have to make a lot of modifications in order to really get the most out of these life-prolonging therapies.
Okay. I mean, my experience very much aligns with yours, and it's not always clear from the trials of how that was managed. And so it seems like you're telling us, or you feel that many patients would not ultimately be eligible for trials in your practice and other practices as well. How do we use real-world data to help us understand how to treat our patients in those scenarios?
Yes, and I think this is where we really should be going as a field, and especially as we have more and more medical record data, and we have the ability to understand these complex features across the entire country, and as we have digital imaging and laboratory values available for our statistical analysis and possibly even AI, I think real-world data can really fill a gap in patients that are not necessarily eligible for clinical trials, but that still we need to figure out how to manage their care and what is the best treatment for them. And as we've discussed, it's really actually probably a larger portion of our patients that fit into that group, and that is really where I feel like we don't have as much information. And real-world data, if done appropriately and in a group with the types of comorbidities that we have, I think can really inform our practice and give guidance so that we can really, help our patients and, to live the best lives and, as lives as free of cancer as possible.
Yeah, I fully agree. When you're thinking about real-world data, can you tell us more about what are the different sources of real-world data? I'm happy to add in here, too, for our patients with cancer. And then are there strengths and weaknesses of these different types of data? Because I think most of us are very familiar at looking at clinical trial data and thinking through clinical trial data. But as I hear you talk about, and I've looked at the work you've done with real-world data, I think it's an opportunity to not use real-world comorbidities, real-world age as an excuse to not treat our patients with the right therapies. It's we should go learn how these therapies work in those patients and take advantage of the data sources that exist. So what are those data sources and what are your thoughts around them?
Well, when I think of real-world data, they typically come from two large sources. So the first is typically from a medical record or very clinical data that tends to have lots of things like laboratory values and every imaging scan and things like that. There's also claims data, which comes from the insurers and places like Medicare or other sort of networks of companies that provide medical care. And so one of the things that I really like to do is, can we have data sources that combine both? Things that are clinical, that are related to the patients, as well as claims and utilization of resources. And so one of the best data sources, of course, it's where I work, is at the Veterans Affairs, because we are our clinical care and we're our own insurer. So we're really able to have the best of both worlds to be able to get the best data that we can on our veterans. There are also data sources that are out there. There are several companies that are able to combine, as well as different sources that can be used. And there are some that are practice specific, several in urology. But really, the goal is can you get as complete of a picture as possible? And that's why I commonly do work in the Veterans Affairs, because I really do feel that we have such a breadth of patients across the entire country, and we have both sides of the data house, the claims as well as the clinical data.
Yeah, it's unique to be able to see it both sides. I think another place that you sometimes have the access to see both sides, but not with the power of numbers that you have at the VA, which is so unique, is that we can look to kind of academic centers when they pool multiple academic centers as an opportunity to explore outcomes in non-trial patients. Yet there are still limitations of that data, because when we think about that data, that's still patients who can get to an academic center. It may not be representative of everybody, but it does give us some granularity. And I think one of my takeaways, and I hope a takeaway for everyone from listening to this, is that real world data from all of these different sources can complement clinical trial data. They're not in competition with one another. They're there to help and complement each other so that we can get each patient the best treatment possible and improve their survival with metastatic prostate cancer. And so, I mean, you're definitely an expert in real-world data and generating it and evaluating it. When you're looking at real-world studies, whether this is for oncologists or patients and patient advocates, how do you recommend interrogating the results that are generated, the real-world evidence generated?
Well, definitely. I think that's such an important thing, because we have such a wealth of data. We really have to try and focus in on the specific population and the specific question. And so one of the ways to do that is actually to sort of simulate a target trial. You know, what is the disease space or the disease situation, whether it's hormone sensitive or androgen pathway modulation sensitive or resistant, and then who are the patients, and you know, what are your inclusion criteria, similar to what you would do in a prospective clinical trial. I think that applying that to a real-world data retrospective observational analysis is incredibly key, so that you're really able to tease out if there are any differences. Because otherwise, it's really hard to find a signal in the noise if you don't somewhat limit and sort of really define your population so that you can answer that question.
When I'm looking at it, two things. One is I run a lot of clinical trials at big academic center. But it really is, when I work, whether it's with people like yourself or industry partners, I'm always impressed that it's oftentimes the same exact protocol documents that we're putting together beforehand, mm-hmm. clearly defining eligibility criteria, clearly defining statistical plan, prior probability. So there is rigor. Actually, the FDA provides guidance
yes.
of how this should be done, because the goal is to do more and more of this moving forward. So I think that's definitely one component of it. And the other one that I look to as interpreting data and results is I like when we have multiple data sources that converge upon the same finding. Ideally, it's filling a gap that wasn't filled by a trial, and then convergent data all supporting the same observation. Because it gives me a lot of confidence then that, hey, these different people did it different ways, mm-hmm. but it's kind of coming at the same thing. And then sometimes when you get conflicting results, it leaves you kind of saying, well, I wonder what the difference is and how people did it. And then you can dig into that. So just because there's conflict doesn't mean that something is wrong per se. It just means that you need to dig in more as the reader there. No. Go ahead.
And definitely, as you know, as a trialist, you probably know that patient selection is the most important. And so absolutely. I would say from any, you know, whether it's in a prospective clinical trial, I would say it's even more important in a real world data analysis is how do you select your patients for your question? And that is, I think, you know, incredibly important. You can run the fanciest analysis possible, but if your patient population is not able to answer your question or has other biases, you can't fix that selection issue.
I think of it's slightly different, but I think of the old adage when people do meta-analyses that it's really the quality of the data of the studies going into a meta-analysis. You cannot dress it up afterwards. But that's exactly true. Well, then I think this moves us on to I haven't actually seen this yet, so I want to hear a bit
yes.
about it. And I know this builds off of other work for you, but you're presenting a subgroup analysis in a poster this year here at ASCO, examining outcomes with ADT plus ARPIs, including enzalutamide, in veterans from the VA with de novo, meaning presenting with metastatic prostate cancer right off the bat, and who were elderly, frail, or had high comorbidity indexes. So can you walk us through the results of that? And we'll kind of start there and go from there.
Yes, and so we felt that this was a key question to sort of use our data to be able to understand the outcomes in this key population of patients who are elderly or frail or have comorbid disease. And we had previously shown in prior work that the combination of an androgen pathway inhibitor combined with ADT really did improve overall outcomes. It improved overall survival in patients. It improved the time to PSA progression, as well as the time to next treatment. And that was in the overall population. And here at ASCO, we're actually trying to focus on the patients that have the most benefit. And so the two populations that we looked at is first is the patients with high volume disease. We know that high volume disease is higher risk. Patients have inferior overall survival. So we really wanted to understand that population. And we confirmed in this trial, or in this study, I should say, that patients with high volume disease really did have a benefit of combination therapy with a ARPI. Additionally, the other population that we looked at is that we really have quite a few patients on abiraterone and enzalutamide. Those are our two ones. One, there has been some concern with enzalutamide, with certain side effects and things like that. We wanted to be sure that population is also showing a similar benefit. And so patients who received enzalutamide plus ADT did have a longer survival a longer time to PSA progression and longer time to next treatment compared to patients who received ADT monotherapy.
And I hear that across the whole group. And was that also, did you guys break that out by age or frailty subgroups? And if so, how did you kind of, how did you define it? What were the findings? And how did you define frailty to some degree, especially when you're doing real world analyses? You have expertise here, but I think even, we'll talk about this in a minute, but even in clinic, sometimes it's hard to assess and define frailty ourselves. So I'm curious how you did that.
Well, so, you know, the easiest one is age. We included patients who are older than 65. Also, the Charlson Comorbidity Index has been used for many years. And so if you had three or more comorbidity points, that was included as comorbid. And then frailty. We have a unique frailty index in the VA called the VA Frailty Index that uses comorbidities, but it also adds several other features, such as the use of a walker, or as well as things like using a cane or having other psychiatric illnesses that can combine. And so from our sort of aging and frailty infrastructure, as you accumulate different deficits, not just having a specific disease, but you also have other functional impairments or cognitive impairments, it really adds to frailty. So we use a VA frailty score of 0.2 or higher to identify those patients that were really at risk of adverse events, and as well as, you know, other concurrent illnesses that could have a competing risk of mortality.
And did enzalutamide and abiraterone still show improved survival in those subgroups where I think there, oftentimes we hear community providers express hesitancy in those groups? Were you seeing survival benefit there?
Yes, actually in all different populations. So it was in the entire group, but in each individual subgroup, you know, the patients greater than 75, patients with comorbidities or frailty, each one of them did have a benefit across the entire spectrum.
Well, and just a shout out to you for everybody. I'm not aware of any other data source being generated that has a way to assess frailty. And you guys are doing that within these VA data sets. So I think we're all sleeping on the power of what you guys are doing there, because we don't have those in clinical trials. That's not reported out in registrational trials. That's not reported out in multi-center academic institution data either. So very much major kudos to you guys for that. Okay. And then I think like we'll just transition a little bit more into clinical care at this point. I think we'll start by just talking about what's already talking about, but frailty specifically. When you're in clinic, you know, you're probably not, maybe you have that same score, and I'm happy to talk about how I do it as well, but how are you assessing patients for frailty? And then is it influencing what you prescribe to them or just how you manage them overall?
Definitely. I think that, you know, we have to use all of the information available. So really from the moment that I first see the patient, and I actually have the benefit in my VA clinic of I room my own patient. Oh. And so the patient is in the waiting room and the time that it takes for them to get up out of the chair and get into the clinic room as well, who is with them and how quickly they respond to when I call their name is actually a has been shown in other studies as something called the time to get up and go, and as well as the walking speed, is one of the best ways to measure somebody's functional status, which is, you know, such a big part of frailty. So I have the benefit just, you know, because I have more time with my patients to see how they move, how they hear, how they respond, and then to be able to ask them many questions. The other part that I think is unrecognized, and I don't have the best way to measure this, is who else is around them? Are there several family members? Is there someone who is really advocating? And so those sorts of things is how I manage patients in the clinic, or at least I assess, in addition to the comorbidities that are available in the chart, the number of medicines, polypharmacy, but really that sort of functional measurement that I am able to get is so key, I think, to the assessment.
Yeah, that's stuff again unique. I do not room my own patients, so I can't say I get. But I was going to say that actually, that is one of my key tricks of when I either have concern going into it and I'm reviewing a chart of a new patient, or right after seeing them. Sometimes I'll just start with the prescription for ADT. And then I will stand there as they walk out of clinic and just watch them go.
Right.
And then the other thing is that there's a bit of a trial run there.
Right.
And I see how they do for 4 weeks. I mean, I think In a situation where you're really concerned about tolerance, Relugolix is especially with commercial insurances for Medicare patients, Relugolix is really nice because you can just put it on, and if you run into big problems, you can back off if you're really concerned, and then you can layer on your ARPI at the next visit. Which for me is just if someone you're that concerned, you should be seeing the patient back about 4 weeks later, anyways. But yeah, so I do that one. Another one I'd add in addition to just looking at the comorbidities, is I just look at the med list. That's usually a pretty big clue. Like if you're looking at somebody, occasionally you'll get surprised by somebody who's on 20 plus medicines and looks wonderful. And usually those are people with a lot of pre-existing cardiovascular disease who look good, but have a lot of comorbidities. But usually if they're on 20 plus meds, it's a sign that, hey, you need to be paying close attention to what you're doing here. And maybe some thinking about how you're selecting your ARPIs for those patients. But should you've already answered this for us, but I'll let you answer this specifically. We'll come back to comorbidity burden in a second. But based on the veterans data you have and your clinical experience, do you feel comfortable offering ARPI plus ADT intensified therapy to patients who are elderly or frail if their PS allows for it?
No, I definitely do. I feel like that, it, as we sort of discussed at the beginning, and this is the standard of care, and that we actually shouldn't even call it intensification. We should just call it the standard, that a combination is the standard. It actually should be sort of non-standard if you are only on one drug, and there should be a very good reason why you are on ADT monotherapy.
Yeah, I mean, and I would even kind of just piggyback on that and say that if you are on only one drug, maybe ADT is not the right one for you to be on in reality. Like if you're that worried about someone, and then we all have those patients that you're like, oh, I'm not sure I might really harm this person or accelerate their death. But like, if that's the case and you're in metastatic hormone sensitive prostate cancer and they don't have, you know, tons of disease, think about enzalutamide monotherapy there, because you can put it on and quickly back off of it if you run into problems, and there's no like, oh, I need to get testosterone back in someone who was already in a bad spot to begin with. So I really think there's very limited role for ADT monotherapy these days for anybody.
I do feel relatively comfortable with sort of all of the androgen pathway receptor inhibitors, but we have done some work in the VA that compares at least the two that we have the most commonly, which is enzalutamide and abiraterone. And we have seen signals of increased hospitalizations for cardiovascular disease outcomes with abiraterone. And the other thing that we detected, which hasn't really been reported as well, is there is increased risk of infections that we saw in the VA. It's probably due to the prednisone component that comes along, and then the severity of illnesses that might happen because of adrenal insufficiencies. And then the other one, which we're unaware of, is actually increased risk of acute kidney injury. And then surprisingly, we did not see increased risk of falls or fractures in this sort of more comorbid and frail population. And maybe it's because there wasn't as much of a difference, that the rate was the same. So, at least for me, I feel relatively comfortable prescribing enzalutamide and other therapies over abiraterone for patients in this category, at least based off of my clinical experience and some of the signals that we've seen in the VA data.
Yeah, I'll follow up on that. For patient in my clinic, after the stopCAP data, and I do remember when you had that poster too, but based off of stopCAP and that data that you're just mentioning, I've really cut down my use of abiraterone to very minimal in patients over the age of 75. I mean, we have alternative options in those patients that are equally effective. I feel comfortable with any of the AR antagonist for those patients. I still intensify, but I do it with an AR antagonist. I do not do it with abiraterone. There's just enough data. It's complementary data pointing in the same direction.
Yes.
And we have alternatives, so why not use them? Unless you have some financial issue that really drives you in that direction. I want to circle back to one thing. We've talked a lot about frailty, and we've mentioned comorbidities. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to introduce an idea and let you kind of run with it. The question is always, do comorbidities impact, your prescription patterns? And I think for many of us, the answer is sure. Mm-hmm. It may change which ARPI I'm going to use for a specific patient, but it does not change whether I prescribe an ARPI. And if I see someone that I'm really worried about, like they have a ton of co-medications and I'm really worried about their comorbidities in more of an academic practice, I'm going to be like, it's not a don't treat. This is a let's get them to a lot of specialists. And yes, really, the visit is not going to be just patting them on the back and saying, hey, look, your PSA was 150 and now it's 0.2. We're doing great. It's, hey, are you going to the gym now? Hey, are you seeing the physical yes. therapist? Hey, I've referred you to cardiology now. Like there's a whole team that comes with this. We're fortunate. We have like a lifestyle general internal medicine clinic that helps us out with these guys too. But these are the ones where it's like the family needs to understand that taking care of the whole patient is going to define survival here, but we still need to treat the prostate cancer. Like that's going to allow them to live longer, but we do need to take care of the rest of it. How do you approach that for patients with a lot of comorbidities?
Yeah, we, you know, in the VA may not have as many resources as some of the big academic centers do, but I take over some of the primary care that occurs because, you know, we have found and we know from many trials that patients with unmanaged comorbidities are at much higher risk for cardiovascular and just overall adverse events. And that, you know, patients with elevated A1C or their blood pressure is higher, most of them were actually excluded from some of the clinical trials, especially the higher blood pressure. And we have seen patients have more heart failure events. And so I do feel it's critical to address things and, you know, try to understand the, you know, entire concept of the patient. That's why I've been really enthusiastic about your efforts with cardio-oncology to sort of really try to, you know, assist oncologists with the assessment and then, you know, trying to get management. And I think we know from several of our trials that try to look at different questions of antagonists or agonists, you know, that a lot of them had great cardiovascular care and therefore we were unable to really find a lot of signals. And so what are your thoughts on sort of that cardio-oncology and, you know, the, you know, medicines that really are so important to prevent?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for my clinic, anybody who has, first, we're checking lipids on the first visit, we're getting hemoglobin A1Cs. If you have pre-existing cardiovascular disease, you're going to be plugged into our cardiologist, you're going to be tackling your cardiovascular health. If you have multiple cardiovascular risk factors, I'm going to encourage a preventative cardiology visit, either with our cardiologist or one in their community, if it's easier for them to see one in their community. Because, yeah, I think we have data from lots of sources that tell us, one, a quarter of patients with metastatic prostate cancer will die of cardiovascular disease despite having metastatic prostate cancer, and we can do things to improve that. We have the tools available to us. And my cardio-oncologist at MD Anderson will always tell me as well, like, hey, things are getting better. Like, I have more and more tricks up my sleeve. I have better ways to lower lipids. I have better medicines for weight and glycemic control. So they're improving just as we're improving, and I think that's going to continue to be the case. I think continuing to kind of build on the comorbidities narrative, I know that as we're talking about, you've talked a lot about using enzalutamide and abiraterone both, and we've kind of both addressed abiraterone. I know some providers, and I've in my experience as well, have bring up concern about either neurologic toxicities mm-hmm. or musculoskeletal toxicities and falls with enzalutamide specifically. What's been your experience with that in older patients? Is that a concern, or how do you go about addressing that?
You know, I would say that in both my practice as well as, you know, in the data that we've collected, we have not seen that signal, and that I've been puzzled by that a little bit because we've tried to look for it in several ways. One of the hypotheses is that when you're already in sort of an elderly or more comorbid state, that the risk difference may not be as high, or that the control population, you know, has falls or has, you know, alterations that are at a similar rate. And we're not really able to just to detect that signal. I would say that there are trials from other investigators that really have much better measurement to be able to understand things like cognitive changes, and that we're just unable to really detect that. I would say just in my clinical practice at the VA, I have not seen that difference play out. I am quick to reduce doses of medicines, not to stop, but to reduce doses if someone does have side effects, especially because I feel these medicines are so effective. And just to build on what you said, in our data, you know, more than half of men die without developing castration resistance, which means to me that they are not really dying of their prostate cancer, because you really have to move to castration resistance, and that most of the men in the cohorts are actually dying of cardiovascular and other reasons. And so we're sort of quick to sort of make modifications to prevent those things. And I was going to ask you, since, you know, we've been talking about some of the wealth of data that we have, and that, you know, really, you know, is there any additional questions or things that you'd be curious? Like, what, where should we be going with real world data in the future, especially, you know, as we have, you know, more and more options in patients that we don't really know how to treat them?
I mean, where I want to see us, and I think real world data will play a role in this, but it's also going to be genomic data from real world, but also, you know, bigger centers and post-hoc analyses of trials, is we're like, I think today, if you go look at ASCO's oral sessions, you're going to see that genomic factors to predict or pathologic factors to predict response to therapy are now becoming a thing, these multimodal tools. I really want to see us move to a space where age is not the defining characteristics, where we have multimodal tools that, sure, account for the tumor variables, but also prospectively account for the likelihood that someone's going to be vulnerable to complications of therapy. I think that's going to be clinical factors that I know you're doing work on that. We're doing work on that at MD Anderson as well. But also, I believe that there are going to be genomic, we've identified candidate inherited genes that patients could have, that you could say, hey, if you have this genotype plus this tumor genomic plus these comorbidities, we should do this or that for that patient. So I think I'm hopeful that in a few years we're headed in that direction. And I think we all need to be kind of thinking to ourselves, how can we fill in gaps in that data set so that we can come as a community to that answer?
I completely agree, and that precision does not need to be a, you know, RNA signature or a DNA abnormality. Precision can be, you know, the right, you know, drug for the right patient in the right scenario. And so, you know, I think that we have previously not had the best tools or methods, but as our data, you know, develops and as we, you know, things move into real time, I also share your, you know, excitement for that period of, you know, the future where we can hopefully, you know, provide even better care for our patients.
Absolutely. And then I think final for both of us, we'll take this one on. But as a practical matter, what advice would you share with community oncologists who are maybe hesitant based off of prior experiences about prescribing ARPIs to patients who are older or medically complicated with metastatic prostate cancer?
I definitely, you know, that is important in that, you know, the community oncologist sees such a variety of patients and, you know, of different cancers and types. And so I think that, you know, what people should take away is that, you know, this is the new standard of care and that it works and that outcomes are improved. Now, of course, in any clinical trial, as well as in the real world, we have to make modifications and we have to adjust. But I think that we should be, you know, willing or at least attempt to start a combination therapy of ADT plus an androgen receptor pathway inhibitor. It really, you know, for the patient is probably, you know, the best likelihood of having a durable long-term response and really, you know, living best life, and that things can be modified in the future. But it is important to do that combination.
I agree. And I would say for the community oncologist, lean towards, and if a patient over the age of 75, medically complicated, lean towards an AR antagonist, yes, instead of abiraterone. You've heard that message come up consistently among the two of us. Get specialist involved or other specialist involved from the beginning. Get cardiology involved. Call up the primary care doctor. I think most primary care doctors, when they see cancer, they kind of check out. They're like, hey, this patient has cancer. That's going to define the outcome. But we've just told everybody it's the comorbidities that can also define outcomes. So get a team together. Stress to the patient the importance of resistance exercise, physical therapy. They will all short up, but yes, and continue to prescribe doublet therapy for patients. And I'd say, again, if you're going to go with one therapy, maybe it's the ARPI, actually, instead of the ADT for those patients.
Well, I would agree. And, you know, actually, enzalutamide is likely to become generic in the next several years and will be even more of an option for some patients who might have financial challenges or difficulty. And so I think we should feel very comfortable, you know, prescribing these medicines in these situations and, you know, and then, you know, get good at them, because it really is, you know, the amount of patients with prostate cancer, you know, based off of many studies is actually increasing, and our ability to detect the disease is only getting better. So I think the number of patients with metastatic prostate cancer in all states is going to be increasing, and we really need to figure out how we can best provide care for this population.
Marty, thanks for letting me talk about prostate cancer with you this evening. And also thank you for the work you're doing at the VA to fill in some really critical data gaps. I think it's doing a lot to move the needle for our patients.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Hahn. And yeah, love that our conversation today.
Awesome. Thanks, Marty.